We continue with our 9 days format. Very interesting lectures based on the reaction of our audience this year. Everyone extremely happy with our choice. There's a recent lecture series, Europe and the Jews, by Rabbi Beryl Wine. There's Europe and the Jews Part 1, which is 5 lectures, and Europe and the Jews Part 2, which is 5 lectures. We are in Europe and the Jews Part 2. The second lecture, it is entitled Imperial Europe. Information about Rabbi Wine's lectures at 1-800-499-WEIN, 1-800-499-WEIN, or rabbiwine.com, rabbiwein.com. Thursday morning broadcast, you are listening to JM in the AM.
This lecture concerns the rise of imperialism in Europe and its effect upon the Jews. The beginning of the story is naturally in the 15th and 16th centuries, when the Spanish and Portuguese explorers left Europe and discovered Africa, eventually America, new routes to Asia. The world shrank, and just as in our time, air travel has shrunk the world considerably. And because of the fact that the explorers were in the main Christian, the Spanish and Portuguese were Roman Catholic, the English were Protestant mainly, but because of their religion, they not only discovered, but they also converted. They were bringing good news to the unwashed, to those who didn't know better. And there was a sense of civilization, almost of noblesse oblige. The good people in the world had to somehow raise all the other people as well. And if they didn't want to be raised, then they killed them. But their motives, so to speak, were noble. The other main motive, aside from, and that's why you find many of the explorers were missionaries. Many of those who discovered the inner recesses of Africa and America as well were missionaries, priests who came to create bastions of Christianity among the heathens. This always presented a problem to the Jews, because the Jews are living, it's the same idea that happened in the Crusades. Why should we have to travel all the way to the Middle East to Christianize the Muslims? We got the Jews next door and they're not Christians. So what should we do with them? And that problem existed here as well, because the pressure for missionary activity was great, was very well financed, not only by the church, but by private organizations as well. Because after all, you're doing a favor. You're creating heaven for them. And here in the middle, you've got all these people who are not Christian and who are stubbornly not Christian. So what about them? So to a certain extent, the missionizing of the heathen exacerbated the Jewish problem in Europe. Because now the question arose, what do we do with the Jews? Now, another reason that really drove the establishment of colonies and of discovery was all of the legends about wealth, gold. There were cities of gold. There was magical places where gold was in the streets. And so therefore we had to find those places, travel there, and get the gold. And in our time, there still are gold miners, but the idea of a gold rush that existed in these previous centuries is practically unknown in our world today. But then it was very, very big. It was something that people wanted to do. You can make your fortune overnight. For instance, the great gold rush in San Francisco and California in the 1800s brought about a sizable Jewish emigration to the west coast of the United States because there was gold. And the gold mines of South Africa and the diamond mines of South Africa attracted tens of thousands of Lithuanian Jews to leave Lithuania and move to South Africa. Now, the Jews were not the miners in the main, but they were the suppliers. You know, if you wanted, you had to have food, you had to have equipment, you had to have mining equipment, and the Jews were the ones that ran the stores and were the suppliers in the gold rush. All gold rushes peter out. Some people make a fortune, some don't. It so happened in South Africa that there were Jews that made a fortune in the diamond business, Bonatto, Oppenheimer, etc., and they really set the diamond business for centuries. They ruled it. But it was an idea that somewhere there's a way overnight to become wealthy, which is something that people always are looking for. They're looking for the magic bullet. They're looking for the one thing that'll do it. And it's much easier than working 50 years or just plodding along making a living. And therefore, the impetus for immigration, for Jews starting to leave Europe, which began already in the 1700s. The Jews went to the West Indies with the Spanish explorers on Christopher Columbus's expedition. There were many Jews that were part of the expedition. That's where the rumor began that Columbus himself was of Jewish descent, which may very well be true. And since Europe was not very friendly to Jews, and since Jews were downtrodden and in the main poverty-stricken in Europe, if there was a place in the world where one could, so to speak, make it quickly, easily, and have a better life, that certainly was attractive to Jews. And from there we have the legend that our ancestors taught us that the streets of America are paved with gold, or that you just have to, you know, you can pick it up. So America remained a land of opportunity, but it wasn't paved with gold. But the idea of people leaving, and you're going to have millions of Jews leaving Europe, a very great wave of immigration that was driven by the fact that they believed that somewhere the streets were paved with gold, and somewhere they would be able to make it. And without understanding the impetus for immigration, then you don't really understand the whole story of why Jews left. We're talking about 2.5 million Jews leaving the Russian Empire alone in the 19th century. And that was a substantial number of people relative to the entire Jewish population. It was almost 25% of the world's Jewish population picked itself up and left. Now, those that came to the land of Israel did not come for gold. There never were any rumors that the streets of Jerusalem were paved with gold. So that was more or less an ideological and religious immigration. That's why people left. But all the other immigrations, South Africa, Australia, the United States, South America, the West Indies, people left because of the fact that they felt that they would become wealthy. And if they didn't become wealthy, their children would become wealthy. And that was something you couldn't dream of in Eastern Europe. In Europe generally, there were very few rich Jewish families. You know, you had the Rothschilds, etc., but that was not representative of the mainstream of Jewish life. And that's why you have Tevye singing, "If I Were a Rich Man," because that was what was on their mind. And rich was always relative, right? The rich man in the shtetl could be poverty-stricken, but he was a little less poverty-stricken than his neighbors, so he was the rich man. But wealth in terms as we know it today, affluence, that never existed before in the Jewish world. Yeah, so to a great extent today, our streets are paved with gold. Now, the Spanish and Portuguese, when they came to a place, they said, well, now this belongs to Spain, or this belongs to Portugal. And that's why in Brazil, which is a country, an enormous country, with such a big population, speaks Portuguese. And South America speaks Spanish. And America used to speak English. Because of the fact that that was the language of the explorers. And the explorers imposed their language and culture and their religion on the places that they came to. Now, this gave rise to the age of imperialism, empire building, colonies. Europe had an idea, aside from the religious angle and the personal financial angle, they also had a national angle that colonies would create great wealth for the mother country. In most cases, this did not work out. The English were an exception. The English were able to make the colonies pay. And because they wanted to pay even more, that's why you had the American Revolution, the tea tax, etc. But they wanted the colonies not only to be self-supporting, but to bring income into the mother country. Now, in the 19th century, after the Napoleonic Wars, the competition between the great countries in Europe lay in imperialism and in colonies. So first of all, there are different empires here. So you had, for instance, the creation of the German Empire. And Germany was, before Napoleon, was 100 different little governing bodies. Dukes, barons, little places. And now after Prussia had defeated, together with England, had defeated Napoleon, Prussia became the dominant power in Germany. And the Prussians eventually took over all of Germany and united it under Bismarck, under the Emperor, the Kaiser. And Germany became the largest country in Europe in terms of population, in terms of the army, in terms of the economy. Germany was the engine. Now, that caused its neighbors to be nervous. And the two main neighbors to the west was France, and to the east was Russia. Poland didn't exist then. Poland was divided between Austria, Prussia, and Russia. And therefore, there became a competition. This national competition not only was for power in Europe, it was for power in the world. And so Germany wanted colonies. And Germany claimed colonies in Central and East Africa, which brought them into competition and confrontation with England. England was the supreme imperial power. There was a time the sun never set on the Union Jack. England controlled almost a third of the world's surface and 25% of the world's population. The British imperialism, Disraeli was its great champion. They were able to take over India. India is an enormous subcontinent. Today it has almost 1 billion people. But then it was hundreds of millions of people. And you had like 10,000 Englishmen running 600-700 million people who lived in India. And India was a prophet. All the companies are called the East India Company, the West India Company. And the fact that in the Caribbean they called it the Indies because of the fact that India represented, and the fact that the Native Americans were called Indians, India represented the triumph of imperialism. It paid to be an empire. And the empire was supported not from Europe alone, because Europe did not have the resources to do so, but it was supported by the rest of the world. And England was the master at it, Australia, New Zealand, and it populated it. Originally, Australia was populated as a penal colony. They took people out of the jail. Maybe that's why it was so successful. There's a legend, I don't know if it's true or not, but whenever I visited Australia, they told me the legend that on one of the ships, 9 Jews came on the ship. They were prisoners. They were taken out of a debtor's prison, whatever. And so they sent the message back to England, send us another Jew, so we'll have a minion. And that's how the original synagogues in Australia began. But all over the world, the English flag flew, and it was very profitable for England. Now, Disraeli was the architect of it, but it was continued throughout, even at the end of the Second World War. Winston Churchill said, "I did not become Prime Minister to preside over the dissolution of the British Empire." But that's exactly what happened. And so you had competing empires. So Germany, Cecil Rhodes, who was the British explorer and governor in Africa, so he dreamt of a swath of Africa, north to south, from Egypt all the way to South Africa, under British domination. So you had South Africa, and then you had Rhodesia, and then it was southern Rhodesia and more than northern Rhodesia. Today it's Zambia and Zimbabwe. And then you had Kenya and Sudan, and finally you get to Egypt. So England controlled the middle of Africa, and Germany is in the middle there. Germany controlled part of Uganda. The French controlled other Mali and other countries that exist today. They still speak French there. So you had all of these competing empires rubbing up against each other. And because of this, you had constant friction, constant danger of war. But at least the war was not in Europe. The war was going to be in Africa, was going to be in America, was going to be in South America, was going to be in the West Indies. It was not going to be in Europe. Now, the Jews reacted, as I mentioned, to all of these colonial developments, and they saw it as an opportunity to get out of Europe, an opportunity to make a fortune, an opportunity to have a better life. Now, what happened was that you had empires that did not have colonies. The Habsburg Empire, which was Austria. Austria controlled Hungary. The Austrians and the Hungarians didn't like each other. It's hard to like either of them. So what happened was that in order to keep the empire together, they made what was called a dual monarchy. The dual monarchy meant that the emperor of Austria was the king of Hungary as well. And it was called the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which was very unwieldy because Hungary had parliamentary rights. It could veto certain things. And on top of it, Austria looked to have an empire in Europe. Austria is landlocked. They didn't have any ports on. So they wanted to have ports on the Adriatic. In order to have ports on the Adriatic, you had to control the Balkans. Now, the Balkans is a swath of land that is riven with blood for thousands of years. Different ethnic groupings that just don't like each other, never have liked each other, and often make war against each other. We had a Balkan war in the 1990s, and in fact NATO today still has a large force of troops in Bosnia and on the Serbian border in order to try and keep the peace. So Austria, there was Croatia, there was Slovenia, there was Serbia, there was Montenegro, there was Bosnia, there was Kosovo. All of these are different groups, many times different religions. The Slavs basically were Russian or Greek Orthodox, while the Croats were Roman Catholics, Slovenians. And so you had this religious war. And Austria is trying to blend all of this into an empire, which meant that they're always making war. Part of Austria's problem was that they controlled one-third of Poland. The Habsburgs, after the Napoleonic Wars, so Poland was divided. As I mentioned, so Prussia, Germany took the northwestern part, and Russia took the eastern part. The southwestern part of Poland, Galicia, was taken over by Austria. Now, Galicia had an ethnic group called the Ruthenians, who are a type of Roman Catholics. Poland is very heavily Roman Catholic. It's the most Roman Catholic country in Europe, far more than Italy. When you took over Galicia, you got a lot of Jews also. You got, not only that, you got Hasidic Jews mainly, because Galicia in the 19th century had turned 95% Hasidic. And there were great Hasidic rebbes there. And Austria didn't know what to do with them, because these are Jews that are readily identifiable. They don't look Austrian. They are not interested in being Austrian. So what do you do with them? On top of it, Austria controlled then Czechoslovakia, Bohemia, Slovakia. And there was a heavy Austrian-German influence. The Chasam Sofer, Moshe Sofer, who was the leading Rav in Slovakia, and was the Rav in Presburg and Bratislava. But he spoke German. He wrote in German. So there was an element that, so to speak, was more amenable to Austrian influence. On top of it, reform had struck deep roots in Germany and in Austria. And because of that, both Germany and Austria had edicts of tolerance in the 19th century. Their idea of solving the Jewish problem was to assimilate the Jewish population into the general population, so that within a period of time, Jews would disappear. There would be millions of people who had Jewish antecedents, but there wouldn't be a Jewish people. There wouldn't be a Jewish society anymore in Austria or in Germany. And the means of doing this was by these edicts of tolerance, which gave Jews rights. It made them almost full citizens. It opened up the universities to them. It gave them a chance to really enter the non-Jewish society in Austria and Germany. In Russia, that never happened. The Tsar never relaxed the discrimination against Jews, which turned Jews into revolutionaries and to people who left the country as soon as they could. Now, this imperialism within Austria, within the Austro-Hungarian Empire, ran into a different problem, because there's another empire next door, and that was Turkey. That was the Ottoman Empire. Now, the Ottoman Empire, we have the vestiges of it here in Jerusalem. We still have the walls of Jerusalem that were built by Suleiman. Jews here were under Muslim rule. Now, the Ottoman Empire was enormous. It controlled parts of the Balkans. It controlled Greece. That's why, till today, Greece and Turkey still don't like each other. And look at Cyprus. That split between the two. The entire Middle East and all of North Africa were all under the Ottoman Empire. But the Ottoman Empire was corrupt to the core. And Turks found it hard to control it and hard to rule it. And the Ottoman Empire became known as the sick man of Europe. And because it was deemed to be less powerful, especially Austria, though other countries as well, began to pick up pieces of the empire to take it away from the Turks and incorporate it for themselves. And this was especially true in the Balkans. So there became causes that were celebrated causes in the world. For instance, I think we should put this into our perspective as well. The way there are causes in the world today that are fictional, Palestinian state, etc., but everybody's for it. So in the 1890s, there was a cause of Greek independence, that somehow the solution to the world's problems lay in getting Greece independent of Turkey. Lord Byron wrote poetry about it. There were many organizations in England that raised money and supported the idea of Greek independence. And eventually, through war, Greece became independent, which didn't do much to solve any of the world's problems, and didn't do much to solve many of the problems of the Greeks themselves. But it was an example that you could bite off a piece of the Ottoman Empire, and by so doing, you would increase your empire. And therefore, Austria, there were Balkan wars in the early 1900s. There were two Balkan wars. So there was Romania, Bulgaria, Greece, Montenegro. They all fought each other, Serbia, and whatever. One won in the first Balkan War, it lost in the second Balkan War. The reason that that's important, because that's the precursor to World War I. And World War I is what changed the world until today. It's not World War II alone, it's World War I. It's not for naught that it's called the Great War. And this affected the Jews. Not only the Jews who lived in the Balkans, but it affected Austrian Jewry. It affected the Jews who lived in Czechoslovakia, and it affected the Jewish outlook on the land of Israel, because the Ottoman Empire controlled the land of Israel for... the walls were built here in the 1500s, and from the time of the Crusades onwards, the Muslims controlled the country. So when you spoke about Jews going back to the land of Israel, you meant that the Jews were going to leave a Christian country, which had, so to speak, some understanding that the Jews come from the land of Israel, not necessarily that they're entitled, at least they come from it, to a Muslim society where the Jews had no rights at all. When the Ottoman Empire started to weaken because of the pressures of Austria and also of England. And Russia wanted always to have an outlet from the Black Sea to the Mediterranean. And they wanted the Dardanelles, the Straits of Bosporus. So Turkey and Russia have an old, old dispute about that, which today is we see it, right? Today they shot down a plane, which just reignites all the old enmities. So the land of Israel somehow, because the Ottoman Empire became weak, Jews felt that somehow we could think about going back to the land of Israel because the Ottoman Empire wasn't going to be able to stop us. Also, in the 1800s, every major empire in Europe had a foothold in Jerusalem. So you have the Russian compound, German colony, the French, the Greek colony, all the neighborhoods, England. And these consuls that were here, the consulates that were established by these empires, their job was to undermine the Ottoman Empire. That was their main job. And therefore, even though the Jews in Russia had almost no rights, but Russian Jews that lived here in Jerusalem in the land of Israel were nominally under the protection of the Russian consul. And the Russian consul had intervened on their behalf so that it became a boon to have Russian identity if you lived in Jerusalem, but not if you lived in Vilna. So one of the strange things that occurred. I know my Zayde was able to leave Israel and come to the United States on a mission that he was sent here by the Rabbonim here. So he was able to leave because he somehow had Russian documents, and the Turks had to honor it and give him permission to leave and to enter, etc., etc., simply because he was a Russian citizen. But if he would be in Russia, he had no rights at all. So this competition of empires made for strange opportunities to arise. It also colored the Zionist movement because of the fact that the Zionist movement, when it arose, never really took into account what we're going to do with the Muslims in the country. They viewed the country as being empty. And therefore, the Jews were going to develop it, and they were going to build here, and they were going to do, etc., etc. What about the other people? There are no other people. And that has led to untold conflicts and errors and different policies, etc., because all of a sudden we realize that there isn't other people here. And just as the world once wondered, what do you do with the Jews? And now the Jews wonder, what do you do with the Arabs? What do you do with the Muslims? But because of the fact that everything was seen in imperial terms, and because Turkey was the weakest empire, the Ottoman Empire was seen as failing, so the Jews felt that they did not have to take it into account. They didn't have to do anything about it. And we see, therefore, that the Jews never really attempted to influence Turkey or the Ottoman Empire to allow Jewish immigration here. The Jews only put their pressure on England and Germany and the European powers because they felt that the European powers are the ones that had the ability to implement this kind of a change, whereas the Ottoman Empire, even if it wanted to, did not have the strength or the influence to be able to accommodate it. So again, in the war of ideas and empires, the Jews had to choose whom they would back, which side they would be on, and which side would, so to speak, facilitate a better life for the Jews, either through immigration or through nation building to all of the things that happened in the 20th century that we are the heirs to, that we know all about. Now, the English had a fascination in their imperialist view, so they thought that the whole world should be English. And you see, their influence remains. So the English thought that somehow the Jews had a relationship to the land of Israel. The British viewpoint is very strange. For instance, there were the Scottish Church, the Anglican Church, all somehow toyed with the idea of the Jews coming back to the land of Israel. Disraeli wrote a novel. Disraeli became a very wealthy man, being an author, something which has escaped me. He became a very wealthy, and he wrote novels. One of his novels was called Tancred. And Tancred was the story of a great hero, a knight, a messianic figure, who comes and redeems his people and brings them back to the Holy Land. It's a strange, strange novel because of the fact that, in effect, he is predicting Zionism. He is predicting the fact that the Jews are, but he doesn't, his hero is not Herzl, and the people are not the Jews, and the Holy Land is not necessarily described as Palestine. But if you read the novel in the milieu of 19th century England, you know exactly what he's talking about. And he saw it, because Disraeli was the supreme imperialist. That's why Queen Victoria loved him, and he made her Empress of Victoria of India. That added one of the titles, and she was the queen for 75 years. So, in that atmosphere, they're built up an idea that somehow England can be instrumental. Now, it was going two different directions at the same time, naturally. When Herzl testified before the British Parliament, attempting to gain their approval for the Zionist idea, one of his great arguments was that if you will give us a national home in Palestine, no more Jews will come to England and you'll be happy. Because then there was a large wave of emigration from Eastern Europe to London, especially to the East End, and all immigrants are resented, and the Jewish immigrants were certainly resented, and therefore his appeal to them was, I'll solve your problem if you'll solve my problem. Your problem is the Jews are coming to England, and so solve my problem, give us a place to go to. That was the reason, for instance, that Lord Palmerston, the British Foreign Secretary, offered Herzl Uganda as a place where the Jews could go. Now, interestingly enough, Herzl bought into the idea. He said, okay, Uganda is fine. They paper-coated the idea that the Jews would somehow spend 50 or 100 years in Uganda and learn how to run a country, and then we could transfer them. Of course, nobody ever asked the Ugandans about it, because that was also part of the idea of imperialism, that the native population doesn't have any say in anything. They are not, they're of a different race and a different culture, and they just don't get it, and they're not entitled to anything, and we're going to pursue our goals the way we want to do it without taking other people into consideration. Also, the Germans controlled part of Uganda. Nobody asked them about it either. But the Ugandan proposal was brought before the Zionist Congress in 1904. And Herzl made it a point of personal privilege. Herzl said, if you reject this proposal of Uganda, I will resign. I will no longer head the Zionist movement. And here we have also very interesting bedfellows. So the Eastern European socialists, secularists, atheists, they all voted against Uganda. They said Eretz Yisrael or bust. We didn't wait 2,000 years to go back to Uganda. We want to go back to Jerusalem. We don't, you know, Weizmann, all of these chevre, they were the ones they were the ones that vehemently opposed Herzl. They said, "You want to resign? Resign." The Mizrahi voted with Herzl. They voted because they felt a personal loyalty to him. Rabbi Fishman spent the rest of his life explaining the vote. And the Uganda proposal passed the Zionist movement. It passed at the Zionist Congress. But immediately after that, tragically, Herzl died at a very young age. He was 44. He was completely burned out by his efforts. And Uganda never got off the ground as a practical matter. But that was an example of... So aside from Uganda, you had other ideas like this. You had a Jew by the name of Baron Morris de Hirsch, who was a German billionaire who helped build railroads all over Europe. And he had an idea, we're going to take the Jews... See, everybody wants to take the Jews out of Russia, out of Eastern Europe, because everybody agreed there's no future in Eastern Europe. They didn't know how right they were, but they all sensed that. So we're going to take them out. Where are we going to do with them? Where are we going to put them? They can't do anything. They can't read. They can't write. They are not, they're not really good material. So what we're going to do is we're going to retrain them. So that already began in Russia, the Ort schools, which still exist here in Israel. Were meant to retrain Jews to make them somehow have some skills, because they said you couldn't build the... And then this is a continuing discussion that we have today in the state. They said you can't build a state with the Talmud. Now, the Hirsch bought land all over the world, in Argentina, in Chile, in North Dakota, in Vineland, New Jersey, in Memphis, Tennessee, and all the places that he bought were meant to be Jewish colonies. And so that's why the great synagogue in Memphis till today is called Baron Hirsch. And until a few years ago, there was a thriving Jewish community in Vineland, New Jersey. There also was a thriving Jewish community in North Dakota. It no longer exists. But all over the world, he bought land and he paid for Eastern European Jews to settle there. But he couldn't pay for, 6-7 million people to go. And he couldn't buy enough land for that. And he met with a lot of resistance because of the fact that he himself was not a religious Jew, even though the places that he bought all had a religious infrastructure. He built a synagogue, he built a mikveh, he built an eruv. They had all of that. But nevertheless, it's very hard to get people to move. The inertia is enormous. Especially if you're used to it, right? You've been for generations in this shtetl, in this town. So where are you going to move to, North Dakota? Or where are you going to move to, Netanya? And that's when Netanya wasn't Netanya, right? People didn't want to move. And overall, the religious establishment, the rabbinate in Eastern Europe, always opposed immigration. Immigration to anywhere. Simply because of the fact that when you move, you change. And if you're moving to a community that is not established and well known as a Jewish center of faith and of knowledge. So then if you move there, you're taking a risk. And therefore, they were opposed to all Jewish immigration, even to the land of Israel, and certainly to the United States. Now, we look back in perfect hindsight, and we say, what if? What if the rabbis in the 1890s and the early 1900s said to all the Jews, you know, I'm the Rav of this shul in Vilna, well, let's all pick up and we'll go to New York. So we would not have been in Vilna when the communists came and when the Germans came. But that's perfect hindsight. And no one foresaw what was coming. You know, Bernard Lewis was a great historian. In fact, he was the expert historian on Islam. There's many, many books on it. So he was once interviewed. And the interviewer asked him the natural question, Professor Lewis, what is your prediction about Islam? What's going to happen here? So he said, my friend, I'm a historian. Historians make predictions about the past. So that's perfect hindsight. We can play the what if game. And naturally, there's a lot of guilt, let us say, associated with it. But who knew? We could only make predictions about the past, not about the future. So the Hirsch's experiment really fizzled in spite of all the money he put in and the effort, etc. And his competitor was Rothschild. And Rothschild put the money into the land of Israel and has been enormously successful, is remembered, whereas Hirsch is not really overly remembered. There was another baron. The end of the 19th century is the age of the three barons in the Jewish world. So there was Baron Edmund the Rothschild and Morris the Hirsch, and there was Baron Ginzburg, who was a Russian nobleman, one of the few Jews that achieved nobility in Russia under the Tsar. And his solution, everybody has to have a solution to the Jewish problem, otherwise why are you a baron? What makes you better than Shmulek next door? So the answer is, I have the solution. I know what to do. So Rothschild said, we'll make colonies in the land of Israel. Again, that's imperialism. It's Jewish imperialism. So, today, imperialism has a bad name. But there was a time that it was like appeasement also today has a bad name. But there was a time when those policies were seen as positive things. And those were positive names. So Rothschild said, we're going to build in the land of Israel. The Hirsch said, we're going to build all over the world. Ginzburg said, we're not going anywhere. We're going to stay in Russia because Russia is our motherland, and that's where the Jews are. I mean, why should we move millions of people? This is where they are. But we will develop a new Jew that will be acceptable to the Tsar. Now, here we have the idea, again, of the new Jew. Nobody likes the old Jew. The old Jew wasn't much worth. But we're going to create the new Jew. And that's what the socialists wanted to do. To a great extent, that's what Zionism wanted to do. That's what the assimilationists wanted to do. We're going to create the new Jew. The new Jew is somebody that has positive elements to him. We can live with him. So we're going to create the new Jew in Russia. We're going to force all the Jews to speak Russian, not Yiddish. We're going to force all the Jews to have a good Russian education, to know Tolstoy. We're going to force the Jews to be patriotic and serve in the Russian army, not try to avoid service in the army. Pay the taxes. In other words, we're going to make the Jews the model citizens of Russia. And then the Tsar will love us. Now, that was a utopian scheme, to put it mildly. because the new Jew wasn't going to be much different than the old Jew. And not only that, again, the religious establishment would never agree to such a platform. And the Jews that were no longer under the religious establishment were being radicalized by the left. So they certainly were not interested in it. They were going to build the new Russia. Not the new Jew, the new Russia. Without the Tsar. So Ginsburg's plans never materialized. If you go to St. Petersburg, to Leningrad, what they call it today, Petersburg, they call it, yeah. If you go there, there's the beautiful Jewish synagogue, the main choral synagogue. And if you go to the front row, there is a plaque there that's Baron Ginsburg's seat. I sat in it, but it didn't do much for me. But so there always are these pie-in-the-sky solutions to our problems. And when the imperialist world opened up, the world of colonies, and you can go anywhere in the world and change cultures, etc. So that gave great impetus to the Jews. I think that without imperialism, the Zionist movement could never have gotten off the ground. Not only never got off the ground in terms of the non-Jewish world, it never would have got off the ground in terms of the Jewish world. But now that we were in such a world where the Union Jack was in Australia, so why couldn't the Jews be in Jerusalem? People are moving. There's colonization. And again, the world of imperialism made no allowance for the native populations. And that was, that doesn't sound nice today with our current political correctness, but that was really the key to its success. Because had they made such an allowance, so then the United States would be, everybody would be a Cherokee. So to a great extent, Israel came a century too late. Because a century earlier, the solution here in the Middle East would be obvious. But it's no longer possible. But this age of imperialism really had a great and positive effect on Jewish aspirations and served as the engine that would drive us into the 20th century.
This concludes this lecture by Rabbi Beryl Wein.